Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking about Wisconsin State Parks and Trails. And with us, Michael McFadzen, current president of the Friends of the Kettle Moraine State Forest, past policy chairman for the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks, and for 20 years, a member of the State Trails Council. It's great to have him with us. You know, in 2017, if I'm not mistaken, Wisconsin spent less on state parks per visitor than nearly any other state, or maybe any other state. It's according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum and the National Association of State Parks Director. And Michael says now it could cost as much as $1 billion to fix all the infrastructure problems that exist. So we're going to take a look at our state parks today. And as we do, I hope you'll join in. What's your experience been like at our state parks? Good, I hope. Have there been issues? What should we be doing to conserve those state's natural areas for future generations? Give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Michael McFadzen, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Larry, I've been a fan of your show and WPR.
Well, it's great to have you along today to talk about our parks. You know, we should just set the stage and maybe talk a bit in general about our state parks. How many do we have? It's somewhere around 50, isn't it?
Well, you know, we really have, Wisconsin has a wealth of public lands and waters. There's, at last count, I think it's 66 state parks, 44 state trails, 10 state forests. There's several recreation areas. There's 15,000 lakes, tons of rivers and stream. And in the state of Wisconsin, about 6.6 million acres, or 17% of Wisconsin's land, is open to the public, according to SCORP, the Comprehensive Outdoor Recreation Plan. And these parks, you know, are the gems of our state, and probably some of the most diverse and scenic landscapes in the Midwest. And I just would like to mention a few, and hopefully some of your listeners have been there. Willow River in the Northwest is incredible. Copper Falls has those huge gorges and waterfalls. Wyalusing, you know, lies at the confluence of the Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers. And we have all the Lake Michigan parks, you know, Kohler Andre, Point Beach, Harrington, and perhaps the best urban park in the Midwest, Lakeshore State Park in downtown Milwaukee. So, you know, we're truly blessed to, you know, to have these kind of resources.
We are indeed. And I was thinking, as you were ticking off those parks, I visited every one of them. And I have never been disappointed. How many people visit our state parks every year? It's a lot.
Yeah, and that's a great problem to have. Right now, it looks like there's more than 20 million visitors a year. But, you know, this declining infrastructure and deferred maintenance, you know, creating a state land system that many of us think is at the breaking point. Mm-hmm. There's an estimated deferred maintenance and project cost totaling almost $1 billion. Wisconsin is underfunding our state parks infrastructure, operations, and staff. In comparison, and, you know, want to look at our neighbors, Minnesota and Michigan leverage almost three times the funding into their state land system. And so now there's approximately 6,000 projects that parks need to have remedied. Now, these include decaying roads, bridges, building, dams, you know, water infrastructure, septic systems that are failing. And this isn't fluff. These are health and safety items. And that number, that $1 billion, doesn't include trail repairs. And there's hundreds, you know, possibly 1,000 miles of trails the DNR can no longer maintain. And, you know, and the problem's further complicated because parks have fewer permanent and limited-term employees to fix these things. And this cost does not include new construction, which would be valuable, like visitor centers or contact stations.
So there's a lot that's going on. And I want to say, you know, you said 20 million people. So that would be, how many people do we have in the state? About 5 million?
Yeah, 5 or 6 million, correct.
And 20 million visits. So, and you know what? Even if you don't visit the state parks, I just as an aside here, I think you still benefit even if you don't visit.
Yeah, people come to our to all of our state lands. The, you know, the trails and the recreation areas and the forests. You know, it's a way to get. It's positive for our mental well-being, for our physical well-being, and it brings tourism into the state. There's a huge economic benefit.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, if you look at things like flood control, clean air, clean water, I mean, all of that you get in our state park system. So I think that's pretty important. Mary Kay in Kenosha has a question or a comment.
Hi, I would like to see a statewide lottery, just the state, not all over the United States. And that portion of the lottery money would go into parks.
Mary Kay, thanks for calling. Well, Michael, we're going to get into funding, but what do you think about funding as that as a potential source of income?
That's you know, a great idea. You know, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan park systems, they're similar size and properties. You know, Minnesota parks are, you know, better staffed. They have more programs. And they get money. They get $6 million a year from their lottery revenue. But they also get $18 million from their Legacy Park and Trail Fund, and you know, approximately $24 million from the state's general fund. $1 million from user fees. So they fund their parks to the tune of about $70 million. Now, Michigan State Parks, and I want to compare a couple of these, and then we're going to go to Wisconsin. They also have several revenue streams. They have a $500 million endowment fund. They get oil and gas tax revenues, user fees, a recreational passport. And in 2022, they funded their parks at over $80 million. And the latest data I've seen pegs their park funding for fiscal 2024 at over 90. So again, we're looking a little over 70 million for Minnesota, 90 million perhaps for Michigan. Wisconsin funds its park operations at approximately $19 to $20 million annually, which equates to about $3 a visitor, which is less than any other state in Texas. You know, we spend relatively little on parks and recreation compared to other states. On the percent of state budget that goes into parks, Wisconsin was ranked 48th. And I just saw a report from the National Association of State Parks Director that cites that Wisconsin spent the lowest amount of parks nationwide at about $1 per visit compared to $3 nationally. So we're kind of at the bottom and starting to show. And one of the reasons, you know, we're one of the only park systems in the country that funds its operations almost solely from user fees. And that, you know, this transition to a self-funding model kind of views parks as a commodity, you know, and ignores planning and upkeep. And, you know, the self-funded user fee model, you know, it doesn't work. And it's starting to affect us, but it's really going to harm, you know, the next generation of park users.
So, you know, I'm thinking about the number of people who have visited. At the same time, I think that we've lost around 40 full-time positions over the last 15 or so years. And yet the number of people visiting has doubled.
Right. Due to legislative mandates, parks lost, that's a good point, they lost 40 full-time equivalents in the last 15 years with visitation doubling. You know, and this includes cutting key positions, you know, like naturalists and educators. And the reason this is really important, Wisconsin has had this lifetime ethic of natural resources. And, you know, the first place that a lot of youth or families, you know, connecting to natural resources are at parks, you know, and that can create a lifetime ethic. And we cut some of these key staff. You know, what happens? You go to a park, you know, it looks nice. I mean, they're the gems of our state, but we really need to maintain some of this property. And it's not just all about having, you know, beautiful bathrooms. It's about this natural resource ethic, which we want to continue to maintain.
Yeah. Michael McFadden, our guest today, president of the Friends of the Kettle Moraine State Forest, talking with him about our state forest, our state parks, and inviting your thoughts and comments on all of this. What's your impression of our state parks? What should we be doing to improve them? Or are you happy with how they are already? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at our state parks today, our Wisconsin state parks, with our guest Michael McFadden, president of the Friends of the Kettle Moraine State Forest, a member of the State Trails Council for 20 years he was, and representing cross-country skiing in that part of that state trails system. One of the many things you can do in our state parks is cross-country ski, for sure. Questions, again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Patrick in Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Do in our state parks is cross-country ski, for sure. Questions, again, the number is 800-642-1234.
Patrick, are you there? Patrick left his radio up instead of just listening to on the phone, and so that's why. Patrick, turn your phone, your radio down. We'll try. Maybe we can try later with Patrick. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Kelly in Portage County called to say they visit state parks every day and wants to know how to volunteer to help maintain trails.
That is a great, a great example of what we need to do. You know, there are key organizations that are making a difference in this bleak funding environment. Friends of Wisconsin State Parks is called FWSP. It's an umbrella group for the 80 plus friends group. And might be, you know, these are the only organizations that espouse advocacy and do a lot of volunteerism on state lands. And FWSP, you know, and the friends group have stepped up big time. You know, these friends groups, they're tied to a particular trail. You know, there's the Friends of Devil's Lake or the Friends of Peninsula. And these groups have played a critical role in fundraising, helping pay for program, the volunteer stuff, which your listener asked about. And these groups have leveraged over $100 million in projects and tens of thousands of volunteer hours, you know, which the state can't provide. So, you know, they fund education-related activities, trail work, hiring naturalists. You know, they're really doing some heavy lifting here. And if you can really make a difference by joining one of these local friends groups or FWSP and make it happen locally. You know, friends groups do great things for parks. Another side of this is user partnerships. The DNR has had to rely on 501c3s. You know, they're critical to maintaining current offerings. Locally, I live near the Kettle Moraine State Forest, and there's a, I'm just going to cite one club. They're called the Kettle Moraine Nordic Ski Club. They've done a lot. They've built buildings. They've taken over trail grooming. They buy and maintain equipment for the Greenbush ski trails. They paid for and installed a lighted trail system, and they support a youth ski team. So organizations like this, there's two great avenues, Friends of Wisconsin State Parks and these partnerships.
Good points. Let's go to Tim in Madison. Your turn, Tim. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me on. This is a great topic. I really appreciate you guys talking about this today. I just wanted to comment quickly. I've traveled all over the United States to many different states, and it's funny that you brought up both Michigan and Minnesota as comparisons, because that was the big comparison I've noticed in the last 10 to 15 years. Just the upkeep of their parks and how much better they're doing than Wisconsin. I've been witnessing over the last 25 years a slow degradation of and starvation of the Wisconsin State Park system that is really starting to become apparent. And I think many people are starting to notice this. In addition to the degradation of the facilities, we're seeing a degradation in services where the people who are mistreating the parks, you can't even report them or do anything about it because there's not even staff to report them to. It's reported to the camp host. Well, nothing ever happens. And it's just a slow degradation of the facilities as they're being slowly abused. We need to find a better way to fund our park systems, and we need more staffing and people out there. And once again, I'd like to say thank you to all the people who are participating in the friends groups who are helping, but it's only a Band-Aid on the system. So I really appreciate you guys talking about this today.
Tim, thank you for calling. Comments, Michael?
Well, you know, I think eventually, you know, we do need to talk maybe a little bit about politics. You know, the Wisconsin legislature is majority Republican, you know, so they control, you know, the committees, the hearings, the bill. And, you know, there's kind of an emphasis on not funding, investing in state lands. And it just started back in 2011 with the gerrymandered voting maps, and which have become, you know, which we just had a Supreme Court remedy. But I just want to point out that there's individual Republican legislators that have been park champions. You know, natural resources is and should not be a partisan issue. One of the best is Senator Rob Coles from Green Bay. He's written and got passed key water infrastructure bills totaling over $15 million to repair necessary health upgrades in our system. And that made needed improvements at 36 properties. And other key legislators that I've worked with and other groups have is Representative Joel Kitchens from Door County, Ron Tussler in Central Wisconsin, and a Joint Finance Committee co-chair, Howard Markling. So there's certainly support on both sides of the aisle.
Vanessa in Plymouth, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I'm just concerned about what seems to be clear-cutting in the Kettle Moraine Forest up by Plymouth, and you know, what kind of forest managing is that we leave just dumped behind? And then what is that money going for? Not upkeep of the state parks, it doesn't seem. So just kind of wondering what that plan is, and it's something most people don't see unless you're taking scenic drives in the Kettle Moraine or maybe during the Ice Age Trail.
Michael, you're pretty familiar with Kettle Moraine.
It's kind of funny. My wife is starting to call it the Kettle Moraine Unforest. and I, too, have witnessed this. That's another legislative mandate. In the past, they had two divisions of forests in our state. The southern forests, like the Kettle Moraine, those, and then the northern forests, like the Northern Highlands. The northern forests are kind of considered working forests, but the legislature has made requirements now on logging, and they're shifting the use from primarily being recreation forests to being recreation and management forests. So that's something that's happened over the past decade, and I share your concern.
So where does the money go from that? I mean, somebody's making money on that. Do you know?
You know, I really can't answer that question. I have a feeling that it goes in the state general fund, but it might go to DNR specifically, but I'm not sure.
Vanessa, thank you for calling. Alice in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I was just calling. I grew up in Sparta, Wisconsin, and I was right by the railroad tracks. And I just was so pleased when we went rail to trail.
So you think the rails to trail system is great?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I used to put pennies on the rail, and when the train went over, we'd grab them when they were, you know. I just think that was one thing that we should be so proud of, because you can go all over now. I see, you know, the bikers, and it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful.
Well, thank you, Alice, for calling. Michael, a comment?
Elroy Sparta, I think it was the first rail to trail in the country, and I've been on it. It's an incredible natural resource. But I'd like to just spend a moment, you know, talking about, you know, how on the operational side, as far as staffing, you know, I want to credit, you know, these employees are working very hard. They, you know, State Park and Forest Staff, they come into natural resources for a reason. And, you know, they're dedicated individuals trying to make this underfunded system work. You know, state leaders are kind of out of touch with this troubled reality of, well, where our system is headed. You know, we have in Wisconsin and our state park system, they have a segregated park fund, which is monies that the parks and forests have saved through efficient operations, but the legislature controls it. So this is money that the parks have saved, and they can't access it to invest in property or wages. You know, it's a challenging era.
Kathy emailed to say she and her husband recently drove from Madison to Governor Dodge State Park in Dodgeville. She said they found the bathrooms in sad shape, leaky faucets, and wet floors. Kathy's husband uses a power chair and facilities for people with disabilities seems to be pretty limited. Comment on that?
You know, I know they're trying to expand the limited access options, but, you know, I don't know how robust it is. I'm familiar with some parks, and I know we've just, our friends group, just funded and had installed an accessible related kayak launch, and that's at Mothy Lake in the Kettle Moraine. So I know some properties have made some progress on this.
Mary in La Crosse emailed to ask, and you did touch on this, but bears repeating. Mary says, weren't the state parks previously funded in the budget? When did this change, and why?
So what happened was probably, I think it was about 2015, we had equal support from GPR and fees. And then that was before 2015. And then the legislature passed and Governor Walker signed into law, that was 2015 or 2016, that cut all tax support for parks. So again, this is one of the only parks systems in the country that has cut this support. So we became self-funded by user fees, and that's why, you know, it's you know, we're $19 million per year, and I think we should talk about, you know, some of our options. You know, I've been a little more doom and gloom, but we've got some good options to get the system on track, which again 20 years ago was one of the best park systems in the country. And you know, we really need to restore some of the GPR, you know, resume some tax resources. And, you know, almost every other state in the country has that. And you have to question how we veered off that path. You know, so restoring some GPR tax contribution, most people support. But then besides restoring GPR, a lot of people believe that we need to adopt the Michigan passport model. So right now you use a sticker to get into a park. So what this passport model is, it occurs concurrently with your annual driver's license renewal. When your license is renewed, there'd be a box to check to opt in. You'd pay an additional fee for the passport. So approximately 40% of Michiganders opted in in 2023. And that Michigan raised on that alone, they raised $37 million. And that's on that passport alone. While Wisconsin, we received only $19 million from our park sticker and user fees combined. And recently, Governor Whitmer proposed automatic enrollment. So when you renew your driver's license, you would automatically be enrolled for Michigan state lands. You know, Minnesota, they passed a constitutional amendment that dedicates a portion of sales tax to outdoor recreation, and they've supplied over $350 million. And that was established through a constitutional amendment. And most taxpayers applaud this funding and would vote to provide additional monies.
Michael McFadden, our guest today, as we talk about our state parks, and you can join in too. Numbers 800-642-1234. Love to hear your impressions. You can email us to talk@wpr.org as well. Keith and Egan, Minnesota, they say emailed to say they moved to Minnesota for family issues after living in Wisconsin for a long, long time. And the Minnesota state parks, he says, are spectacular. And for comparison purposes, he suggests go to both sides of the interstate park, interstate stay park, to see the difference. There is not much comparison. Would you agree with that, Michael?
You know, I've not been on the Minnesota side, but this is kind of a symptom, you know, of the whole park system. You know, I live in the Kettle Moraine State Forest, and in the Kettle Moraine alone, they have 500 requested projects. You know, most of the infrastructure in the Kettles was built in the 1970s, you know, the buildings, the bathroom. So it's over 50 years old, and even older. The forest headquarters and other structures were built by the WCC in the 1940s. So, you know, we have a lot of, just one example, the Long Lake campground septic system is failing. Numerous pumps costing $30,000 each have failed. Sewer lines are cracked with you know, rainwater infiltrating the system. In one electrical repair episode for a water pump, a new solenoid, so they're trying to retrofit this into a water pump that's 50 years old. A new solenoid took out several adjacent elements due to non-compatibility issues. So, you know, once the needed part is found, it often can't be used because the amperage or voltage is different. There's, you know, 90 buildings in the Kettle Moraine. 80% of these are bathrooms. All need upgrade or repairs. So this is a long time coming. I mean, this funding was cut in about 2015. And, you know, we have potentially a new legislative body coming in the next election. And we're trying, there's many of us who are trying to put these issues at the forefront. And a lot of this isn't just having, you know, pristine bathrooms. It's this, we need to connect people with natural resources. We have this, you know, often, as I've mentioned, you know, the first time you're exposed is at a state park, and you have a naturalist who does a program. They tell you where to hike, you know, and this builds this natural resource ethic, of which Wisconsin is famous for. And as your caller pointed out, it's not just there; it's throughout the system.
Another question from an emailer. If user fees are the primary source of funding for state parks, what does that mean for smaller state parks further from population centers? If those parks get fewer visitors, does that mean they don't receive much, if any, revenue for operations?
You know, I'm not privy to individual properties, but that caller makes a good point. The larger parks, I think there's four state properties. I think it's the Kettle Moraine Peninsula, Devil's Lake. I believe there's one more, get about 25% of all the visitors in the state. So they probably get a little better funding. But yeah, it's as that earlier caller mentioned, it appears they're starving our state park system.
Georgia in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Georgia.
Oh, got to mute my, hello?
Hi there. What's on your mind?
Hi, you can hear me?
Yes.
Oh, what's on my mind is just talking to Joel, who used to edit Silent Sports Magazine. Your guest has a regular article on all the issues that are important in Wisconsin for people who are interested in being outdoors and skiing and biking and canoeing and all those things. So I just want to put in a plug for that little magazine and also to read Mr. McFadden's articles.
All right. Silent Sports. Comment, Mike?
Yeah, thank you so much. I write the silent alarm column for the magazine, and the magazine and website covers the whole Midwest sports scene. We do concentrate more on Wisconsin, but it includes the hiking, biking, paddle sports, cross country skiing, destination articles, and the editor Bruce Steinberg has done a great job of placing this magazine at the forefront of these sports. Now, my column deals, with these political realities of what's happening, the causes for concern. Some of the articles that I've been involved with or written have been on PFAS, wakeboarding, the Wisconsin Wolf Plan. There's proposed mines at Porcupine Mountains and Boundary Waters, state land funding, and we highlight organizations that make it happen. And so this has really allowed me to track what's happening on our state lands and get an understanding of where it's headed. So thank you for the magazine plug, and I'm sure my editor will appreciate that.
Okay, Georgia, thank you. Rick in Ozaukee County will take your call. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, thank you for the subject. And I just want to make a comment on any time that we have a mandatory tax or a tax that everyone has opted in when registering a vehicle. I don't agree with that. I think that's a little bit on the deceiving side when you're registering your vehicle. So just a comment about that. And then also, I really enjoy the park system here in Wisconsin. But I got to say, when I go out west and instead of paying exorbitant fees to go inside a park there like Yellowstone and Yosemite, just to go across the road, state lands in Wyoming, you're free to travel all over the place, and there are campgrounds all over the place. And I really like that model. The access for the ordinary person is it's less expensive and more you're out there in nature rather than on a paved road. But what would that look like in Wisconsin if we went from a park to a forest? What would that look like? That's a question for Mike. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Michael?
Well, we have parks and forests, but the western part of the country has much more public land than Wisconsin does. And a lot of it is open. There's not, depending upon the property, if it's a state park, they have facilities. A lot of the open lands or forests or BLM lands do not. I also want to get at, I think the caller made a good point about, the fees. If we look at that Michigan passport system, you have the choice of determining whether you pay that extra 12 or 14 bucks. So you can say, I'm not going to pay that, and then you won't have that park access on your driver's license. And one thing I think we have to keep in mind is how big outdoor recreation is in Wisconsin. So according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which you mentioned earlier, Larry, outdoor recreation added $8.7 billion to Wisconsin's economy in 2022, supported 89,000 jobs, and recreation industry alone accounted for 2.4% of our gross domestic product, which ranked Wisconsin 16th among the country states. So recreation and parks are huge in Wisconsin. And a study by a study on the Wisconsin park system found out that the overall economic impact on just the parks is $1 billion a year, providing 8,200 jobs and $350 million in income. So, I mean, we got to keep in mind that our parks and lands are an economic driver, with many locales depending upon them for tourism. So and I think, you know, sometimes our state leaders need to be reminded what they bring to our state.
Rick, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. And Steve in Minneapolis, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Sure. Mr. McFadden, I read your article in the Silent Sports, but, you know, states fund different things based on the values that the people hold in the state. And, you know, it's education, it's transportation, it's all those things in parks. In Minnesota, the people went to the ballot box and voted for this because it was a value that we have. Maybe the people in Wisconsin don't value the same thing. I'd like your comment on that.
Steve, thank you. What do you think, Michael?
Oh, that's an excellent observation. You know, I think it just points out that the people value it. You could tell by the callers, you can tell, but the legislature isn't quite, you know, tuned into that. And, you know, again, in Minnesota, they have that big land and legacy fund. And as everyone has pointed out, their facilities are so much better. You know, Wisconsin, we continue to visit our parks, but, you know, we're not funding them right now. So, you know, the question is, what is going to happen, you know, in the short term and long term?
Steve, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Eric and Tomahawk, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Larry, your guest is spot on. That Joint Finance Committee tries to stop state projects as well as privately owned conservation projects like the recently accomplished Pelican River Forest in Oneida County, which just hosted 80 mycologists from the Wisconsin Mycological Society that came up there and found 282 varieties of mushrooms. It infused $50,000 into the local economy over the last 4 days. And we better watch out for this because they were so, the politicians up north were so angry that that private landowner wanted to put their land in an easement. They brought the American Stewards of Liberty up from Texas, and they are infiltrating our county comprehensive planning to wipe out even more conservation efforts. They're also a drafter on the Project 2025 that's appearing as a campaign thing. So, Larry, great guest. Michael, thank you so much.
Michael, a comment from you.
Thanks. You know, just... you're reiterating, you know, this huge issue. And I want to give you an example on the operational side, what happens in our state budget. You know, last year, parks utilities, and this is, you know, the electricity, the gas, the water, you know, these are the bills that we all have to pay. And for 44 parks in these state lands, it ended up being $1.3 million. So, but in the budget, in the state budget cycle, the JFC, as you mentioned, parks got $300,000. So they know that their bills for utilities is 1.3. That's a loss of $1 million just getting out of the box. So they have to make that up somewhere.
Our guest today, Michael McFadden, we're talking with him about our state parks. He is president of the Friends of the Kettle Moraine State Forest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about new innovations in upcycling plastic, and we'll also talk about the use of hydrogen as an alternative fuel and some other things as well with our guest. Right now, we're taking a look at our state parks with Michael McFadden, who is president of the Friends of the Kettle Moraine State Forest, and Jason and Cudahy up with a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So, you know, I do, me and my wife, we do a lot of traveling outside of the Milwaukee area to go up to parks out to Kettle Moraine or Lapham Peak, you know, and just all over the state. And I just never understood why, you know, so many Republicans are against funding the state parks when there's so many Republicans that represent those, you know, their districts and areas are a lot of areas where, you know, you go to find these state parks and whatnot. I just, you know, I guess I just never understood why, you know, you'd think that they would want to fund the parks to bring in more tourists, not just from, like, you know, people like me and my wife, you know, in Milwaukee, but also, you know, out of state. You get so many people from, you know, the Illinois area going up north to Door County and everything. And so I just want to make that comment. I just never understood why they're so against it.
Jason, thank you for calling. Michael?
You know, natural resources should not be a partisan issue. And I think what happens is that, you know, the one of the goals in the current legislature is to build the surplus. And, you know, and I don't know the exact amount. I think it's between $4 and $6 billion, maybe more. And that's money that, you know, potentially invested, you know, could really help us maintain employees better. And these employees are great. You know, the salaried staffers in state parks are working well over, you know, their hours. I wish I could give you an exact answer, but I really can't.
Peter in Dane County, we'll go to you. Peter, hello.
Hi. I just said I agree with all the funding issues and everything that have been brought up, but one point I did want to raise a comment quite earlier talking about parks out west and how it's, you know, free to go through. I just think it should be noted that it always is and has been free to drive to access any state park. You know, it's really the fee is just to park your vehicle. So it's always free to walk, enter on foot, and you can actually drive through every park for free as well. Not that that helps with the funding, but it's just something that, you know, I think people should know.
Yeah, it's a good point, Peter. Michael, comment?
Right. Yeah, a lot of the state lands use in Wisconsin is free. And then, you know, the 44 parks of state trails, you're required to have a state trail pass if you park, or if you use or a state park sticker. And then if you use the state trails, not the park trails, typically, you need to also have a trail pass.
Peter, thank you. Duke in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Duke.
Hi. I have had some opportunity to work with some of the funding issues and over the last 20 or 25 years. And I think our legislators have not been that interested in funding either the park system or the conservation account. We haven't had a license fee increase for residents for 19 years or something like that. And those things are a lot of management things are languishing as a result of it. But when you start to talk about state constitutional amendments that offer support for natural resources, the two that spring to mind are Missouri and Minnesota as models of that. But they have a tool in those states that we don't have, and that's the citizen initiative, which allows citizens to gather petitions, signatures, to get an item on the ballot. In Wisconsin, the only way to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot is to have the legislature pass in two successive sessions a resolution to put that on the ballot. And we haven't had legislators who were willing to do that and support natural resources. So perhaps a future legislature in its wisdom will take another view of that. But for now, that's one of the reforms enacted by the progressives down around 1900, 1910, that a lot of prairie populist states adopted, and we didn't.
So, yeah. Duke, thank you very much for calling. Some good information there. Comment, Michael?
Yeah, I want to point out that, as Duke said, you know, Wisconsin people use their state lands for recreation, respite, solitude. You know, they're a critical part of who we are. And families, many families can't afford alternative recreation. And I guess the message I'd like to, you know, leave your listeners with again, it's not all about pristine bathrooms and buildings. It's more about connecting families and youth with natural resources. For many people, the first exposure, you know, to natural resources is through a park with a park naturalist. So if we're serious about developing an outdoor ethic, it often happens at a park. So, I mean, if this stuff's important to you, have a discussion with your legislator. Tell them how it affects your community, the economy, recreation. State lands need some general purpose revenue, taxpayer support. And we need to adopt, many of us believe, a passport system like Michigan. Now, I recently met with 8th Senate District candidate Jody Habersinikin, and she's going to include this in her platform. And so I'm hopeful that other legislators will. You know, Wisconsin must explore alternative funding models, you know, prioritize some type of infrastructure investment, you know, really recognize, you know, the vital role these state lands play for our economy and quality of life. And only then can we ensure that, you know, our kids and their kids can enjoy these natural gems. And it would only require, you know, relatively simple move by the Wisconsin legislature, you know, to turn this this ship around.
Yeah. So what do you think it would take to get that passport system installed in Wisconsin?
Well, I know that there's a number of legislators that are looking at it, including one of the ones I mentioned, Rob Coles from Green Bay. I believe park management have studied it. They see the advantages of it. So, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, go to the ballot box, talk to your legislators, you know, what do they care about parks? What I saw some of the Friends groups doing is they were inviting the legislators to come to their property, show them around, and then it really connects. Now, these parks are right in their backyard, and maybe they haven't been there before. So that's something that the Friends groups have been doing, and citizens can do too.
Yeah, there's I think, a lot of effort will have to be put forth by citizens in order to get this done. And I like your idea of the organizations, the volunteer organizations, as a sort of a catalyst for getting this done, directly with legislators, but also with the population, the people who live in the particular areas where those Friends group exist.
Yeah, the Friends groups have been doing more and more out of necessity. These were things, you know, 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago, Wisconsin park system was considered one of the best in the country. And they actually had competitions back then. And we're obviously headed, you know, in a different direction now. And the Friends groups have really stepped up. And, you know, I can't, if this is important to you, that's one of your next steps.
Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I really appreciate the time that you took. And obviously, there was a lot of interest. We didn't get to all the calls, and I've got a whole bunch of emails that I didn't get to. We weren't able to get to either. But thank you, and maybe we can address this again with you down the road. Appreciate your time very much, Michael.
I'd be happy to do that, Larry. Thank you.
Michael McFadzen is president of the Friends of the Kettle Moraine State Forest. He's past policy chairman of the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks and a member of the State Trails Council for 20 years, representing cross-country skiing. Great to have him with us. And we can take this issue up again down the road for sure. Coming up, we're going to take a look at some cool new research on dealing with plastics, and we'll also take a look at some other things, too, like hydrogen fuel cars. There's about 16,000 of them in the state of California. We'll learn more about that next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for staying with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to spend the next hour talking with you about innovative technology in a few areas, but one is to upcycle waste plastics. And Lucas Mastropasqua is our guest today. He is a UW-Madison Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering. Recently received a federal grant to develop new technology in this area of upcycling. I want to say upscaling. I don't know. Luca, why do we do that? Do you ever make that mistake?
Yeah, upcycling is a difficult term to learn. Yeah.
Well, I'll try to get upcycling into my mind. Luca, by the way, is a assistant professor of mechanical engineering, recently received this grant. And he also runs a lab on campus researching alternative fuels and also keeping carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So we've got a lot to talk about with him, and we'll start with plastics. Maybe you're concerned about how much plastic ends up in our landfills and polluting the environment. Maybe you wonder what solutions to the climate crisis our UW scientists are pursuing. Would you buy a hydrogen-powered car if hydrogen fueling stations existed outside of the state of California? Join the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. And Luca, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here.
You know, upcycling versus recycling, what's the difference?
Yes, so upcycling really means trying to create value to something that doesn't have value. So if you think about everything that you throw away, your waste, that for you doesn't have any value anymore. The word upcycling is trying to create processes that give value to a waste stream, a waste product. Mm-hmm. So if we were able to take your trash and give more value and so that we can either reutilize it in different markets or sell it, sell a product with a dollar amount, that means giving value to a waste stream.
So you take an old product and you actually wind up with a product that may be even better than the original product.
Correct. Yeah, and recycling is usually involves transforming, say, a old plastic bag into a water bottle, and that probably that process usually doesn't happen continuously. It cannot happen indefinitely. So the material cannot really withstand that infinite recycle loop. And upcycling often involves a bigger transformation of the product, of your waste. And so that the goal is to increase the that recycling, that upcycling and sort of reuse of that molecules.
Yeah. Now, when you were 16 years old, I bet you didn't think, well, you know what, I'm going to be a professor and I'm going to work on upcycling.
Nope.
how did that
happen? It's a wild
guess. How did that interest develop for you?
I'm not a plastic expert. I'm an energy expert. And when I decided to get into engineering, the country where I'm from in Italy, we have energy engineering as a major. So I started doing energy engineering in Milan, Italy, and that brought me to study new technologies for power generation and to increase the energy efficiency of our grid and reducing carbon emissions and so on. And so I started digging into some of the newer technologies, and that involves electrochemical technologies or reactors. And that's then how I got into carbon capture and hydrogen fuels and so on.
Well, you got a federal grant. You traveled to Washington to D.C. to accept a $500,000 federal research grant, and that's going to support your research on waste plastic upcycling. What's the process you hope to develop?
Yeah, so for that grant, I started thinking, as I said, I'm an energy expert, so I started thinking about the plastic problem as an energy problem and not as a material problem. So the motivation of the work is really trying to displace the use of fossil fuels for producing plastics. So today, only about 7% of the plastics that we produce is recycled. And so there is a large amount of plastics that is wasted. Or
93% of it, from the sound of it.
Yep. It's a great majority of it. And a lot, as we know, a lot of it goes into our oceans and it's really mismanaged. And to produce that plastic, we use a lot of fossil fuels. We use a lot of the resources that we can, we either produce here in the US or we have to import. And that brings sort of consequent CO2 emissions that we emit in the atmosphere for producing that plastic products. Especially, it's around 15% of the total CO2 emissions globally we emit it just to produce plastics.
How much was it?
15.
Oh, 15. I thought you said 50.
No, 15. It's still sort of a...
Still a lot.
It's still a lot, yes. So that amount of CO2 can be eliminated if we found a way to not use fossil fuels to produce that initial plastic product. So, as I said, it's an energy problem. And to produce the plastic products that we currently use, we need petrochemicals. We need molecules that are currently produced in refineries mainly, or chemical plants, that use fossil fuels as an energy source. So those molecules are what I try to produce from waste plastics in this project. So the goal is to take waste plastics, put them in a reactor that will be able to produce the feedstock, the molecules that we generally need to produce the original plastic products, but we produce that feedstock from fossil fuels. So if we were able to recover waste plastics and produce the original feedstock that we need to produce the plastic products in its first place, we would eliminate the fossil fuel component of the petrochemical industry. So again, we have a lot of resource because the waste plastic that we just throw away is enormous. Yeah. So it and that in has a lot of both energy and sort of molecular value for a chemical process. So we could recover a lot of energy and recover a lot of molecules that are valuable. So we just need that technology that is able to get take waste and produce feedstock products, feedstock molecules, using renewable energy. So the reactor that I will be developing this project will be taking electricity from solar or wind, for example, and converting waste plastics into these feedstock molecules. And just to give a couple of names, these would be ethylene or propylene. These are the building blocks that that then go into the chemical industry to build polymers, plastics. So polyethylene, polypropylene, yeah, and so on.
Yeah. What are the petrochemical companies or industry, what are they, how do they feel about that work?
I think it would
think they'd like it. I would think they'd like it.
I think they would like it. It's the these are processes that will take what they are used to use, they're used to handle in their chemical processes, in their refineries, and these are, they will need to convert their processes to eliminate CO2 emissions from fossil fuel use. And petrochemical industry is growing, will be growing. It's currently growing at a pace that it doesn't seem to be slowing down. Yeah. So it's this process will help petrochemical industry transition towards a low carbon fuel, but still utilizing the same sort of infrastructure that they currently use today.
That's pretty cool. So you're taking a machine. I'll put it that way. You're taking a machine. You're running the plastics through it.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of separating out these molecules or feedstocks, which I love that use of that term, into something that can then be made into another product that's actually better than the first one that was there.
Yeah, you will be able to produce feedstock that will be used to, for example, you could produce more plastics.
Yeah.
The input stream is zero value. It's waste.
It
doesn't have any value for anybody who throws away it because they throw it away. So the product will be a feedstock that is currently produced in the petrochemical industry. So the ethylene, for example, will be a feedstock for producing polyethylene, polymers. So we could make, plastic bottles that do not use fossil fuels. It would just take waste plastic bottles, and you could, in theory, close the loop of the plastic cycle using only renewable electricity.
Woo! That's pretty cool. So the process would eliminate carbon dioxide?
So the interesting part is that
the primary cause of climate change, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So it will eliminate the release of carbon in the atmosphere. So the carbon, plastics are very valuable molecules because they contain a lot of valuable atoms. So they contain carbon, they contain hydrogen, and a lot of other additives. And that's why it's a waste throwing them away. So the carbon will stay within the plastic loop. It will not get released as CO2 in the atmosphere in this process. We will be able to break down polymers that contain carbon and produce these molecules that also contain carbon. And we'll keep the carbon...
Keep the loop.
Keep the carbon in the plastic loop. If we used plastic waste for example, fuels production or for energy production, so if we incinerated plastics, that carbon would be released. It would be oxidized and would be released as CO2. So the goal here is to not produce fuels. Yeah. Use plastics for energy generation, so that we don't emit CO2.
Luca Mastro Pasqua, our guest today, he is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering, and he's doing some pretty cool research, isn't he? I love this idea. You may have questions about it. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about some innovative approaches, this one to upcycle plastic. And there's a UW-Madison large grant that is looking into this. And our guest today, Luca Mastropasqua, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison, our guest today to talk about it and some other things as well we're going to get into as we move along with him. Join in, numbers 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Dave, who's driving in Iron County right now. Dave, thank you for calling.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, the question or maybe suggestion is for the professor to clarify the source of original plastic, which I believe is oil, versus his, which is recycled plastic. He hasn't mentioned oil yet. He's talked a lot about energy, which is great. And then both processes, his reactors, of course, use energy, whether it's the oil refinery or his novel process. And I would just like, I would just be curious, the volumes of those energy respectively, or, you know, forecasts on energy savings there. He calls it renewable, but, you know, that renewable could come from anything. Is it heat form, electricity? That's it. I'll stop there.
All right. Thanks for calling. Luca?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So the current plastic is produced from oil. Most of the feedstocks that we currently use for producing plastics, or one of the big one is ethane. So it is derived from oil or natural gas. The plastics that I would take as feedstock in my reactor will be a waste, will be the plastic that it's today produced from fossil fuels. If you imagine this process scaled up in the future, all the plastic can be part of this loop of upcycling and reuse. So ultimately, there will be a transition towards not using oil to make that original feedstock, but keep on converting back and forth these molecules using electricity. So my reactor will not use oil as energy source. It will use electricity. And you're right, the electricity, it depends the source of electricity that you use. Mm-hmm. So it depends where you live, and depending on which state you live in, the source of electricity will differ. My goal is to power this reactor with renewable electricity. So we will have simulated solar and wind electricity profile that will be coupled to this reactor to show that the reactor can be connected directly to a solar photovoltaic plant or a wind farm. Oil is currently in the picture today, certainly, because we need that to produce the feedstock for making today's plastics. The goal is to, if you imagine this process scaled up, is to eliminate that part to produce the feed, eliminate the oil to produce the feedstock, mm-hmm. and keep on converting waste into products, products into waste, and vice versa. In terms of energy savings, this is a very it's a great question, and at the moment I only have predictions. I don't have measured data yet, because we just started.
Well, that's what the $500,000 exactly. bucks is for.
so my expectations is that I would be able to improve the energy efficiency of the process by approximately 70 or 80% compared to the current status. And in terms of CO2 emissions, as I said, because we will eliminate the use of fossil fuels to making plastics, CO2 emissions will also be saved of the order of 70%.
That would be absolutely amazing. Now, where are you getting all the plastics you're going to be? Is everybody saving all of the plastic? Or how are you, what's this process like?
Yeah, so one of the greatest challenges that any upcycling process has, not just mine, is that when we, in our homes, when we take our plastic products and throw them away, we put all those plastic products in one single bin. What we don't know is that all these plastic products are very different to each other. The polymers that make them up are very different in their molecular form.
Sure.
So we need to be able to separate the different polymers in order to make this process easier to produce the feedstock that we really need for the petrochemical industry. So there is a challenge in terms of collection and separation of our plastic trash, mm-hmm. such that we can sort of selectively convert the polymers that we are interested in. I foresee working with collection systems and like municipalities to understand how that process can be how my process can be incorporated into their collection system, and if there is any changes that needs to be made into either my system process layout or in the collection process.
Peter in Eden emailed us to say, according to the book "Can I Recycle This?" by Jennifer Romer, only low number plastics 1, 2, and 3, not 5, 6 or higher, can be recycled. Is this factual? And what makes these plastics unable to be recycled, or can they be used in your process?
Yeah, so that's it's true. So plastic. So again, let's go back at recycling versus upcycling. Mm-hmm. Recycling today usually means taking a plastic product or plastic waste and mechanically shredding it.
Yeah.
Often that means making it in small plastic particles, and that plastic particle is rethreaded or melted and molded into a new product. This mechanical process can only be done so many times because the polymers will degrade if you keep on shredding them and remolding them and so on and so forth. So this cycle is not infinite. The reason why not every polymer, not every plastic can be recycled is that, and this is clear even from our sort of day-to-day life, there are plastics that are much harder than others.
Yeah.
So if you take a plastic bottle, the plastic is different to the plastic that you have in your phone or that make up some of the components in your car. Because they have different mechanical properties, they have different additives. The additives are a major challenge that, as I mentioned earlier, these wastes are very diverse. And if you have additives or colorant, like if you have a black plastic, if you have a transparent plastic, those are different additives that are added to the polymer when you make a product. So the recycling of a plastic product entails being able to manage all this diversity of additives and different polymer structures so that we can make a new product that has the characteristics that we want. You know, of course, we don't want recycled plastic bags then don't hold their load, you know, or their break. So we want to make sure that recycled products have the correct mechanical properties and requirements. So all of these additives and diverse polymers needs to be managed in the recycling as well as in my process to create new products.
But you can still use, your research is looking at which plastics will I be able to use, or do you know that intuitively?
Yeah, so I will start working with polyethylene and polypropylene, as well as polystyrene. So polystyrene is what you usually see in packaging, for mm-hmm. example. Polypropylene and polyethylene are used for bottles and plastic bags. So those are products that I will be able to take from any supermarket and try directly into the reactor that I will be developing.
I'm trying to envision how this might look. 'Cause those products, I mean, they take up a lot of space. Are you going to be crushing them down, or is there some sort of a hopper that is on yep. top that you push it through, or what?
Yeah, so the goal here is to, reduce the size. As you said, the volume is large, so we need to reduce the size. So there will be some mechanical sort of shredding without... again, changing the molecule, the molecular nature of the plastic. So there will be some mechanical shredding, and then the goal is to extrude the plastic waste into the reactor. So the technology is similar to what we currently use for additive manufacturing. So 3D printing of plastic products is being developed, and it's pretty it's a growing market. So there are ways of extruding plastics to make a filament,
mm-hmm.
And that filament can be more easily fed into a chemical reactor.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Jim in Menominee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to let your listeners know of an example of some combination recycling, upcycling, and recycling that is being done by the American Birkebeiner ski race up in Hayward. The racing bibs with the numbers on are made for us by a company down in La Crosse, and the bibs are made from recycled plastic water bottles for the race. And after the race, some people have turned in their bibs. Some bibs are not picked up. Some people don't show up for whatever reason for the race. And so every year the Berkey has hundreds of these extra bibs. Well, what the Birch Leggings Club of the American Birkebeiner has done is upcycled some of these. We've taken the bibs, sewn them into shopping bags, sewed up the bottoms, and make some great shopping bags. And there are a couple of folks with the Birch Leggings Club who have taken extra bibs and made them into quilts and ski bags, mittens. Some really colorful, great-looking things. We've recycled and upcycled the recycled material. Just this past weekend, a group of Birch Leggings Club members met up in Hayward, and we processed the bibs to be recycled again, the extra bibs. We removed the racing timing chips from the bibs, and now the bibs are going to be sent, I believe, to a company out in the East Coast. And the bibs, which are already made of recycled material, are going to be recycled again. We've kind of completed the whole circle here.
Okay. Well, is that upcycling or is it recycling? All of that recycling.
I think that's probably what's considered recycling. The upcycling, it really depends if you increase the value of the product, yeah. But that's a great example. I think I'll make sure to give my bib back when I complete my Birkey next year.
And that's a pretty cool idea, just to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
I like it, Jim. Thank you for calling. Chuck and Eagle, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I have a question for your guest. A little background real quick. I was in the plastics industry for 34 years, and mainly we focused on consumer packaging, which had an array or a rainbow of colors added, pigments and dyes used to get corporations their marketing aspects of color. So the question I have is, in taking the polypropylene that has or ethylene that has colorants in it from packaging, can that still be used in what he is proposing of taking feedstock from those materials and turning it into energy again.
Yeah, so that's great, great point and great question. I think it is one of the challenges for, again, any of the upcycling processes that people are developing. The dyes and additives that I mentioned earlier are one of the big problems. So either we need to be able to separate those additives before we feed them, before we feed the waste into the upcycling, whatever reactor it's going to be, or the reactor needs to be able to withstand those dyes and additives while still producing the correct product. So it is a challenge at the moment for the technology that I'm developing, which is an electrochemistry based process. I don't currently know if it's how sensitive this is going to be to additives or dyes. For other technologies that are usually based on thermochemical reactors, there might be a different sensitivity to dyes and additives, but it's still not a fully proven process. So it is a challenge.
Yeah, but it's part of why you're doing the research.
Yeah, that's why we need to study these processes.
Yeah, absolutely. Chuck, thank you very much. Pete and Racine, we'll go to you. Hi, Pete.
Thank you. I'm very enthusiastic about your guest. Okay, and I've seen outside of a grocery store 3,700 plastic shopping bags, the cheapy, thin types, compressed and melted or whatever and formed into a park bench. And it was a rigid, durable-seeming park bench, which is great. And then they do collect bags at the grocery stores, clean bags they have to be. I remember working at a food bank. We needed bags for cheap, and I had to collect those bags and had to examine each and every one of them because some piggy person threw in a bag with a diaper in there.
Well... Plastic bags. You're going to do this with plastic bags?
Yes. Plastic bags are going to be one of the first products that we're going to try with to feed to these reactors.
Pete, thanks. Beth and Madison, your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hello, Larry.
Hi.
This is Dr. Beth Neary. I have a question, and my question involves, while we're talking about plastics and we're talking about plastic recycling, I think it's really important to know that in the production of plastics, there's many toxicants that are used, such as in the production of polystyrene, a.k.a. styrofoam, they use ethylene, benzene, and benzene is actually a known carcinogen. So I think the bottom line is we have to reduce the amount of plastics because there's also toxic chemicals used in their production.
Beth, thanks a lot. Comment on that, Luca?
Yeah, that's. I totally agree. This is definitely not in. This process definitely doesn't justify the use or abuse of plastics. Further, we certainly need to go in the direction of making bioplastics or biodegradable plastics, and this sort of doesn't compete with going in those directions as well. Ethylene and benzene are chemicals that are produced in large amounts in the chemical industry, and it's true that they have major health impacts. So. It's something that we need to manage and reduce as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Beth, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Stephen kind of wants us to talk about hydrogen and hydrogen cars, and I think we can get to, maybe we'll get to that next. I'm Larry Mueller. Our guest today, Luca Mastropasqua from the University of Wisconsin. He's an assistant professor of mechanical engineering. I'm Larry Mueller. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Luca Mastropasqua, who is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us to talk about his research. We've been looking at his kind of innovative approach to upcycling plastic. And it his work has earned a nice grant, a federal grant, to look into this process. Questions for him about that or something else, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And you're also, you're director of the Hydrogen and Electrochemical Research for Decarbonization Lab, or I like the acronym for it, HERD Lab, within UW-Madison's Department of Mechanical Engineering. What's the overall focus of the work in that lab?
Yeah, so our lab focuses. So I wanted to have those three key words in my name, in the lab name: hydrogen, electrochemistry, and decarbonization. So the lab focuses on integrating electrochemical processes into either hard to decarbonize transportation sectors or industrial sectors, and with the overall goal of reducing or eliminating CO2 emissions. So both hydrogen and electrochemistry are, I think, tools that we can use to get to decarbonization in some of the hard-to-decarbonize sectors. So that's why they are in the name. And in terms of research activities, we span from production of hydrogen or hydrogen derivatives for the transportation sector, the use of hydrogen or hydrogen derivatives in fuel cells for electricity generation with high efficiency, or the integration of electrochemical devices to do carbon capture, to do chemical synthesis, like the plastic project, for example, with the, again, goal to integrate these in the industry.
Let's talk about the hydrogen-powered vehicles in the U.S., and you're doing some work in that hydrogen area, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, there's 16,000, I think, hydrogen-powered cars operating in the state of California, which is the only place.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so the U.S. Has about 55, I think, refueling stations, hydrogen refueling stations that are open to the public, and they're all in California. There are many more scattered around the nations that are not open to the public and that serve private customers. Hmm. So if you look, for example, at USPS or a lot of warehouses of major
corporations,
major industry that move a lot of material. Their warehouses is often powered by hydrogen forklifts. Our mail is moved in warehouses by hydrogen forklifts. Not completely, but in a large amount by hydrogen forklifts. So we know, the industry knows how to dispense hydrogen and to use hydrogen-powered vehicles, at least for the movement of goods in warehouses. And we are transitioning, at least some sectors are transitioning towards the movement of people around in our streets. So
what's the advantage of hydrogen versus, let's say, a regular electric vehicle? I mean, we've got, 3 million at least electric vehicles out there.
First of all, I just want to make, because this is a debated topic.
Okay.
And so hydrogen fuel cells vehicles are also electric vehicles.
Yeah.
The hydrogen fuel cell vehicles have a fuel cell that substitutes our internal combustion engine, gasoline car engine. And then the fuel cell produces electricity. And that electricity is used to run an electric motor. So the feeling that you have when you drive a fuel cell vehicle is the same as the one that you would have driving a battery electric vehicle. They are both electric vehicles. I don't see competition between fuel cell electric vehicles and battery electric vehicles.
Okay.
They shouldn't be exclusive, mutually exclusive. The advantage of using hydrogen fuel cell vehicles comes when you start looking at heavy duty applications. So if you start thinking about pickup trucks or delivery trucks or buses for metro transit authorities or class 8 trucks for the movement of goods across the nation, or trucks that are used in ports, and those are usually in low-income communities with a lot of problems of pollution. Those trucks are very hard to convert into battery electric vehicles because the load that they need to move is so much more than for a light-duty vehicle, a passenger car. So when you want to move a heavy payload, battery electric vehicles are struggle today because they don't have the power, the energy density, and the power density to match that. So at least today, and of course, both fuel cells and battery electric technologies are improving as we speak.
Yeah, of course.
So that's how I see their application today.
Okay, so. Are we going to, you think we'll see, continue to see many more of the hydrogen vehicles or hydrogen in use in various types of vehicles and in different types of situations?
Yeah, I think there are many companies that are developing hydrogen fuel cell trucks or hydrogen fuel cell buses, and the economics compared to fleets of battery electric vehicles is competitive when you think about buses and trucks. Mm-hmm. Also, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles will be competitive when you start thinking about planes or trains. So again, when you want to move a lot of a heavy payload, and you want to go far. So your range needs to be long. That is when hydrogen fuel cell vehicles start to make sense, especially, again, if you want to compare them with battery electric vehicles. So there is, I think, a transition that is happening towards those type of applications.
Joel Patnott, our producer for today, mentioned something about electrolysis technology. Okay, and I didn't catch it all. So what is this technology and something you're working on?
Yeah, so electrolysis is, so when you think about a fuel cell is you take hydrogen and air and you put it inside a fuel cell and you produce electricity. That's a fuel cell.
Okay.
Electrolysis is the opposite. So you take electricity and water, and you split the molecule of water with electricity to produce hydrogen and oxygen.
I see.
So it's the exact opposite of a fuel cell. The fuel cell will emit only water as a product. Electrolysis will take water as a reactant, as a feed stream. It will split the molecule of water into hydrogen and oxygen. So electrolysis is a way, it's not the only way, but it's a way to produce hydrogen, pure hydrogen, for all of these applications. And it's the way that it's currently being studied the most because it allows to produce hydrogen using direct renewable electricity. So if you had a wind farm or a solar panel, you could take an electrolyzer and water and produce hydrogen and oxygen.
That would be very cool if you could upscale that to...
Yeah, believe it or not, there are companies that are already commercializing these systems. And so you, if you wanted one today, you could go and buy an electrolyzer.
Well, that really is fascinating to me. Carbon capture and storage is kind of another area, and you know, we don't have a lot of time left here, but what are you most excited about in this area?
Yeah, so carbon capture and storage has been developed for many years. My role or my contribution has been on industrial emissions. So again, if you take, for example, refineries, or if you take steel plants or cement plants, those are very difficult to convert into electric processes. So it's very difficult to just take electricity that it's produced from solar panels or wind farms and convert a steelmaking process just by using electricity, because of the temperatures involved, because of the reactions involved. So the one way to reduce the emissions of those applications, of those processes, is by taking the flue gas stream, which is mainly comprised of CO2 and water, and separate the CO2 from that stream. So there are electrochemical technologies that I've worked on in the past that are able, they're membrane based. So the membrane is selective to CO2 and not water. So if you have a gaseous stream of CO2 and water, the membrane is able to selectively remove the CO2 from the gaseous stream and concentrate the CO2 in its own gaseous stream, and so that can then be compressed and then either used or sort of stored underground or used for other applications. The use of CO2, it's a totally different topic, which we might not have the time to go into, but the capture process trying to develop technologies that selectively separate CO2 from a gaseous stream. So, and the ultimate example is separating CO2 from air. So there are a lot of technologies that are being developed that are called direct air capture, DAC, where you take air and develop membranes or adsorbent technologies that simply remove CO2 from air.
Wow. So where would you put, I'm trying to think of where you would, how it would be used.
So the reason why it's important to develop those technologies is that there will always be applications where it's going to be very hard to completely decarbonize. So take for example, planes. Planes are really hard to decarbonize. So even if we use biofuels, we might have CO2 emissions emitted when the plane burns biofuels.
But those filters could capture that.
Exactly. So we could deploy membranes on the ground that remove CO2 from air to compensate from the fact that some processes will always emit some of the CO2.
Going to have to talk some more about this with you. Here we are out of time. I want to thank you so much, Luca, for being with us today. It was fun, and I learned a lot. I think everybody else did as well, so appreciate your time. Luca Mastropasqua, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at the UW-Madison, our guest today. Great to have him with us. I'm always pleased to have a great group of people that are helping, and really together we produce this show. Joel Patnod, Clara Neipert, our guest today, Jeff Robbins, our technical director, Lee Rayburn, also another technical director, and Jill Nadeau, our executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller.